How'd I do?
Anybody want to clear that off of the screen there? Thank you. All right, so we are here to talk about intoxication. Don't do it. We're done. Let's go home. Now, I have a pet theory, and I'm going to start with it, even though it might seem wholly unrelated to the topic at hand, but I'm going to use it just because I have a captive audience, and I can't refuse that. So has anybody here heard of the Fermi paradox?
I have. Sorry.
That's fine. I was hoping somebody had. I'm going to have to do this so I can see my notes and the screen at the same time in case somebody raises their hand. The Fermi paradox basically says the universe is vast. There's just infinite space in all directions. So where is everybody? I mean, what makes Earth so dang special? Why are we apparently the only one sitting here broadcasting radio telescopes out into the beyond? The universe has been here for a long time. There should be more of us. There's not. That's the paradox. And I think I know a solution to that. I think I have the solution. And I think the solution is that there are infinite planets with infinite people, sentient beings on them. So that just means Earth is weird. Something happened here that sets us apart. And I think that, you know, three fully modern humans have been on this Earth for 300,000 years, walking around, living perfectly normal lives. You could go back 250,000 years, grab somebody, bring them here, put them in modern clothes. It's a normal person, right? Hundreds of thousands of years this went on. And then about, you know, 200,000 years ago, we started, you know, cooking things. And then 90,000 years ago, we started making tools, specialized tools. But then everything went off the rails 12 or so thousand years ago when we decided we needed to start farming. Agriculture happened. We developed cities, which required money, which required governments and hierarchies and everything, all the concomitant evils that go with it. Why would we do such a thing if we've been living perfectly happy for hundreds of thousands of years? Well, the anthropologists are telling us nowadays that there's a growing theory that they did that because they wanted to get drunk. They found that they could not maintain in the wild enough grain that they could set aside, let rot, drink the rotten water from the bucket of grain, and just get shit-faced. And because they wanted to get drunk, all this stuff became possible, all of civilization. So I picture infinite worlds with happy, you know, people walking around, eating fresh fruit and breathing fresh air and putting their legs into streams and never, you know, perfect, a planet of perfect little Buddhas, never having a single thought about getting wasted. And it's just Earth that decided we needed to do that. And so here we are. Why would we want to do that? You know, why would we do such a thing? It's just, I guess, we just find the day-to-day grind impossibly difficult. So this precept, most of you know the precepts. We've talked about sort of the evolution of the precepts. You know, it started out as rules for monks, right? This was something for monks to live by. Regular people just went along their happy little way. There were rules for people, but they weren't nearly as extensive. That didn't change until it got to Japan. Japan, about 600 years BC, was just a remote little nowhere backwater off the coast of China. There was nothing going on there. And so when they were trying to set up there, they didn't really have monasteries and monks and things to get them into the established tradition using the Vinaya, all the rules and the ordination thing. And so they did what a lot of people do, is they just made up a whole new religion. And they decided, we're going to just trim the fat. We're going to cut it all down to these 16 things. And monks, lay people, everybody, we're all going to take the same vow. And then just that distinction between monk and lay person largely evaporated. And so now we all, even those of us who are not going to ever be a monk, still take the same vows as everybody else. The precept of not becoming intoxicated, I think it started out as a rule for monks, don't get drunk. the rule about sexuality originally was just don't have sex at all, which wouldn't be practical from a, you know, longevity point of view. If you wanted to maintain the religious tradition, you can't have everybody dying off. So somebody has to do something. The precept of not becoming intoxicated originally in the Theravada tradition, the Pali, says, I undertake to observe the precept to abstain from intoxicating drinks and drugs causing heedlessness. There's some key words in there I think I'm going to get back to. By the time of Dogen, that became do not become intoxicated, polish clarity, dispel delusion. In the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma, not harboring delusions is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. And then we say in our precept guide, the precept of not becoming intoxicated in the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma is to avoid harboring delusions, understanding that there is nothing to be deluded about is enlightenment itself. And this understanding makes it impossible to take in intoxicants. I'll first draw your attention to something that appears both in the Dogen version and the Brightway version. And it talks about in the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma. What in the world are they talking about? They say in the realm of the intrinsically pure Dharma. That is in the Pali called Dharma Dhatu, the realm of phenomena, the realm of eternal truth, basically the realm of the mind in its purified state. And when they say when the Buddha mind has been realized, that state you're in is called Dharmakaya. Some of you have done the meal chant with us. And the first person we name is Varochana Buddha, pure Dharmakaya. And that's that Buddha we're talking about, that Buddha that exists in sort of that primordial Buddha state, unobscured by anything, which has sort of an implication that we have this sort of original nature that we have somehow strayed from. And I don't know if that belief is widely held amongst all traditions, but it's certainly something that we sort of maintain. The other thing that I'd like to point to, actually, it's implied in later ones, but it's said specifically in the original Pali, and that is heedlessness. Drinks and drugs causing heedlessness, and pramda in Pali, heedlessness or carelessness. And I think that as we have a discussion about what this thing is all about, that is what we're going to arrive at. The act of drinking itself is not a sin. I don't think Buddhism has sins. We don't do sin. We do consequences. We do karma. And it's the fact that alcohol, something so central to our civilization that we call this alcohol, because we all know what that means, but it's the heedlessness. It is the disregard for the world around us that is really, I think, what is underlying this. And I think that's why in our own tradition, when we say, you know, when you have obtained this understanding, it is impossible to take an intoxicant. I mean, you might even have a drink, but if you exist in that place, nothing would penetrate it. I am going to, at this point, make a remark about alcoholism or substance abuse, which a lot of people kind of drift towards in the subject. And I think that is a red herring, because this is not about people who have an illness or a mental disorder. This is about you. This is about you and your life. You know, if somebody, Buddhism is not here to cure alcoholism any more than it is to cure cancer, right? That is a completely different set of questions. What we're talking about is just the ordinary day-to-day, you know, I'm going to put this glass of wine to take the edge off, kind of. I'm not a problem drinker. I'm just going to do this thing, right? And so I'm not really going to speak on people who are in that state, because that's a completely different discussion, I think. Also, I think that there's something to be contemplated when we talk about that sort of pure Dharmakaya state. Because you start to think about what is an intoxicant. I mean, it can't just be anything that changes the way you view the world. I have been diagnosed with depression, and I take Wellbutrin every morning. And Wellbutrin absolutely changes the way I look at the world. I would be huddled up in a corner without it. Is that an intoxicant? I don't think so, not within the meaning of this, because the thing that is causing me to disregard the real world around me is the depression itself. That is the thing that is hindering me from that. And so the medication gets you there. So something that gets you into a place of where you are more able to engage the world as it is, I don't think would be regarded as an intoxicant. And anything that does is. And it can be the same thing from one person to another. Something that can be perfectly beneficial for one person can be completely harmful to the next. And it's going to be an individual sort of thing. So I am going to encourage people to chime in here. What do we think constitutes an intoxicant? Alcohol is easy because it's right in the name. Does anybody have any other ideas about things that they might consider intoxicants? Leah has some. Leah, go for it.
Cannabis.
Can you elaborate on that, or you want me to keep on rambling?
The THC part of cannabis.
I think THC is an excellent example, because I think there are also people who would say that that is something that absolutely keeps them engaged with the real world. Some people view that as medicine as well, right? Reasonable minds can differ. So
to me, that's a gray area. That's why I bring it up, because it's like, I mean, it's intoxicating, but like you said, sometimes it is used like a medication.
Right. And that's why I think I emphasize that word heedlessness that is in the original Pali. Because if you are somebody who smokes a little weed, gets up in the morning, goes to work, has a full productive day, comes home, take care of your kids, everything's fine. Are you being heedless? Are you abandoning the world around you for some delusion? Probably not. Are you somebody who calls in sick from work because you want to sit home and on the couch and get high and watch dumb movies all day? That might be a different approach. Erica.
Yeah, I feel like anything that somebody uses as an escape, like you were saying, you know, they're not in the real world. So that doesn't necessarily have to be a substance. It can be shopping, you know, it can be social media.
Jenry, you said exercise, that's another one.
Exercise. Anything where you are using it because you don't want to deal with your life, I would say, could be an intoxicant.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Somebody in the chat just mentioned psychedelics. Psychedelics, I think that is going to be a very fraught one. We've talked about psychedelics in here before. I have a lengthy history with psychedelics, so I have very strong opinions on the subject. I don't know. I mean, there are settings. Is Katie here?
Katie's here. And by the way, you do have two hands up. I don't know if you can see
them. I do now. Yeah. I think Katie might be able to address that better than I do. Katie, you want to go for it?
Well, I mean, people do use psychedelics these days, and when Oregon is, I mean, technically we're legal for psychedelics right now under certain circumstances in Oregon. And, you know, it's used as a medicine, as a spiritual aid. I don't know if the Buddha would agree with it though. So I don't really see it, especially in my introduction to it. I haven't seen it abused, but I'm sure it can be.
I've seen it abused. You could totally.
Yeah, I think you and I have talked about that. So
I do have a friend who went on an acid trip long enough that he never really came back from it. So you can absolutely do that. But I mean, I would draw an equivalence between psychedelics and the Wellbutrin that I'm on right now. Because if you're suffering from some kind of severe post-traumatic stress, I understand that in the right therapeutic conditions, psychedelics can get you back to a state where you are no longer burdened by that and able to function more or less normally. I mean, so I can absolutely see where that would be a useful medication for some people, and for other people, it could be an absolute distraction, right?
Yeah, it needs to be, it's powerful. So it needs to be handled with care.
That it is. Susan, you want to jump in?
I think money and power are pretty awful intoxicants in our society now.
I just went on about how I wish we didn't even invent agriculture. So yeah, I'd be perfectly happy without money.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is one of those necessary evils, right? But yeah, that is definitely one.
Well, it may be necessary, but for some people, it's an intoxicant. That's their life.
I mean, and the power thing, you only have to look at the state legislatures and the way they're treating trans people now about how people get intoxicated with power.
Yeah.
So I had my hand up because I had an idea of what it was, which is, it's anything that you find pleasurable that you do more than you want people to know about. So in other words, if you are, you know, I mean, I think I talked about this a little bit last week. If you do Sudoku for 6 hours a day, I mean, it seems like a fairly harmless thing to do, but if you, you know, or you play video games, and you know, a little bit is fine, but if you are doing it more than you want people to know, so that you're lying about it or you're pretending that you're really not doing it, then I think that's an intoxicant.
I see. Drew, you want to go?
Oh, I was wanted to respond to what Katie said.
Mm-hmm.
And what that sounds like to me is that intoxication then is all wound up in this idea of shame, right? I am not so sure I agree that shame is a necessary condition for intoxication. I mean, you can find people who are shameless, right? And also intoxicated.
Jin, are you?
I know, do you want Cassie to go first?
Sure, Cassie, go for it.
Oh, I was going to say, I know we're talking about your skin, but our rage or anger, sometimes we call it like raging on the internal pharmacy, using rage and anger is kind of like a drug or intoxicant. But I think kind of just what I hear everybody saying is whatever the behavior is, just, or the substance, fill in the blank, just exploring the intention behind it. Like, what's the intention behind this, right? If you are, you know, using drugs every day and still being able to hang out with your family, like, why are you using drugs? Like, what is it doing for you? Like, what's the purpose? What's the intention? And that's kind of how I like to explore whatever it is.
What I'd like to add is related to Katie's question, and it kind of connects with Cassie's comment as well. Connection on that question. Katie's question I thought was an excellent one, or her comments. I don't know that I would, well, I probably think shame is probably in there, but to me, and this is based on my own personal experience as well as the experience of many others over time, a surefire way of recognizing addiction. If we're talking about it, if you get intoxicated Friday night and you clean yourself up Saturday and Sunday and you have a great week and that doesn't happen again for a long, long time, that's one thing. If you get intoxicated Friday night and Saturday night and Sunday night and then you need some help on Monday morning, that's an entirely different. And that's when it gets into hiding. That's when I don't want people to know. And my experience has been that anytime someone starts to lie about it, there's a problem. That person's really going down a difficult path. And so the opposite of that, a surefire way to test that is just stop. And if you can stop, then maybe there's really nothing wrong and you just need to rethink your values and, you know, take on healthier habits. But if you can't stop, then that's something to look at. And among all the other things that people were talking about being intoxicating, I think in terms of being addicted to, because there are whole groups of people who look at certain food types as being addictive and therefore they don't have them at all. And flour and sugar are big in that regard. So just some thoughts. So it's a fine line between intoxication and addiction.
Yeah. I'm with Drew on the shame thing, though. I can see somebody being perfectly addicted to somebody. Let's say you go to the gym compulsively to the point where you're letting all your personal relationships go to the wayside. Your health is being affected. I mean, you can exercise too much. I can see that person not giving a damn who sees them doing it. You know, there's just no shame there whatsoever. I've seen people who drink like that. Will just go out and just get completely hammered and get hammered every day and they give a damn who sees them, right? So I can see if you have an awareness to how this is affecting your life, you're probably better off, you know, at least then you on the road to realizing this is a problem. But I think you can absolutely be intoxicated, you know, in such a way or engage in delusion in such a way that you just dwell there.
You got a bunch of chats. I don't know how much you care about that.
Do I? I can't really see them.
Bottom of the screen.
You gonna go, bud? No.
Oh, you can see. Okay, you can see it, but we can't see.
Yeah, I don't think I have any new ones since the psychedelic.
Oh, a lot of those chats probably were the link to the QG.
John, you had a comment? You want to do that one out loud or you want to? I can read it, I suppose. Go ahead and unmute yourself, bud.
Okay. So it was similar to what Shinryu was just saying. I mean, anything that's a source of an addiction might be considered an intoxicant. I mean, could be porn, could be all sorts of different things, could be an intoxicant in that sense. So.
Yeah, I think in order to do that, you would have to cast the net of what addiction is really wide. I mean, I would consider people who obsess over feelings of inadequacy or self-hatred to be deluded. Are you addicted to self-hatred? I don't know. Are you not engaged in the world as it is? Are you in delusion? Yes, probably so, right? I mean, again, speaking from experience, you can be in a psychological state where you are completely detached from reality. But am I addicted to that? I think addiction is the clear example, right? That's the one that's obvious. But I wanted to steer clear of that largely because I don't want this to be about somebody else. You know, that guy's got an addiction. He's got a problem. You know, this isn't about me. This is about that guy. And it's all of us, right? It's every single one of us. So I was thinking about music when I was writing this. You know, you're driving in your car. You're driving home from wherever. You put on music in the car. Are you distracting yourself from driving or not? Is music then being used as a source of delusion? I don't know. Any more opinions out there about addiction? So what's the big deal? Why should we not just indulge these things? I mean, we clearly like them, right? We all do them. We all have our little things that they get us through the day. What is the big deal? And I think for most of us, the answer is fairly obvious, because we take time out of our busy days to sit and stare at the wall, right? We believe we practice living in the moment very intensely. I don't think most people do that, though, in the course of their day-to-day life. For them, just the idea that distraction and delusion is almost a full-time job. Like, that is all you do on a day-to-day basis. From the time you get up in the morning and you whip out the iPhone and you're flipping through TikTok, you know, and you're just every single moment from the opening bell to the closing bell, you're just engaged in that. And I think we would all agree that that is not going to lead to a very happy outcome, right? I lost some of my notes. I was going to do some quotes, and I don't have any now. Oh, well. I have it? I don't have it. So this is the point in time when we usually go into breakout rooms. And unless anybody, Leah, you want to say something?
Yeah, it just occurred to me, caffeine. If I have a big cup of coffee every morning to get on with my day, and before, I'm absolutely dependent on this coffee to, you know, this is about me. Do I need to explore this and feel what this is about as a Zen Buddhist? Do I need to do something?
Is it a problem?
I mean, I seem to need it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's hard for me to go without it. So I guess it's an addiction technically.
Oh, no, it is. Even that's an interesting point, though. You can need things without them being harmful, right? We need all sorts of things, you know, warmth and human affection and air and food. I think from all my training and recovery, I would say, do you really need it or do you just like it? Like, if you don't get it, are you going to die? Because that's a need, right? If you need something, it's not going to be in this realm of delusion, because if you absolutely need something, then you need it. Coffee, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not the only one who is so dependent on caffeine as a substance. That before you have the coffee, you feel asleep. A lot of this could be psychosomatic too, but before you have the coffee, you feel asleep. And after you have the coffee, you go, okay, I'm awake now. I can proceed with my day. So I don't know, it's sort of a gray area, but thanks for the thought process is now
starting. I would wager, however, if you were stranded on a desert island, it would be about 3 weeks before you didn't need coffee anymore.
Right? It takes a while. Because I have been through times in my life where I was not addicted to the coffee. So I know it's possible.
Anything I would characterize as a need, you would not live 3 weeks without. Right?
Fair.
If you can live without it that long, it's probably not a need, it's a want. You know.
Okay.
And again, I don't know that, you know, we're not sitting here saying you shouldn't want anything, you know. Like, music is fine. Coffee is fine. Having a drink is fine. I don't care. If that's something that, you know, brings you joy in life, knock yourself out. The thing that we have to be careful of, though, is how is this affecting other people? How is this affecting my own goals? How is this affecting my values? If you say to yourself, you know, I value family above all else, and yet you find yourself playing golf when you should be with your kids or whatever. Golf isn't bad. Golf isn't evil. But if you're putting golf above other things, then that might be a problem, right? You might be not engaging with the world as it is, I would say. And it goes back to the very beginning when I was talking about heedlessness. Heedlessness of what? Like what are you not heeding if you're being heedless? What are you being careless of? You know, it really does have to do with the karmic consequences. You know, when I was writing this thing, I was thinking a lot about precepts versus commandments, right? Christians have their commandments, thou shalt not do X, Y, and Z, because I think that commandments are proscriptive. They're saying this is the way the world ought to be. And if you don't do these things, you've committed a sin and you're going straight to hell, right? Precepts are not proscriptive. They're not telling you what to do. They're descriptive. They're telling you what's going to happen, right? If you do this, bad shit's going to happen. If you do those things, are you a bad person? Are you going to hell? Not necessarily. You're making hell all by yourself. You're creating your own little hell. And it is just telling you this is what's going to happen. And I think all the precepts are like that, quite frankly, is that you can do whatever you want to. You know, you're just going to have to live with the consequences, right? And that's how you know if something is, I think, a delusion, something is an intoxicant, is by paying attention to that. Then I suppose the trick then becomes, how do you pay attention to that? My answer is sitting on a cushion for extended periods of time, but everybody else's, you know, mileage may vary in that regard. Yes.
Go ahead. This may be just obvious, but I was thinking that I think intoxicants can also be your way of continuing to say to yourself that I'm fine. This isn't a problem. I'm feeling some feelings, but I'm going to have a drink and then I'm going to be fine. Or I'm going to go, you know, even like if it's exercise, take my mind off it and I'll be fine. But you're not dealing with the feeling that you had. You're not dealing with like something that might be going wrong in your life and or in your heart, you know, just pain that you need to experience and not run away from. So I guess that's the way I think of the delusion part, is saying everything's fine.
Yeah. And I mean, you say that it might be obvious. I mean, it might be obvious. But it's not obvious in a way that we all do it all the time. If it was that obvious, we wouldn't continue to do it, right? I mean, it's definitely worth saying. Betty, you want to go?
Yeah, I have a bunch of questions, but they're not formed. They're not articulated in my, so I don't have a question, but stuff that comes to mind is like, you mentioned mental illness and kind of mental health issues around this question of addiction and intoxicant use. But, you know, where it's sort of slippery, right? You have intoxicant use or whatever the intoxicant is, and then abuse, and then addiction. And then the addiction is sort of a mental health issue, maybe a mental illness. But then maybe there's sort of this underlying mental illness and we're self-medicating with whatever the intoxicant is. So it just feels like it's really complicated and potentially messy in there. So there's a lot of questions in there, but I don't know what the question is.
I mean, I think that I can clarify it a little bit because, I mean, I'm not ashamed to say that I'm somebody who has been diagnosed with alcohol use disorder, right? I have drank too much at various times in my life. It used to now... alcohol use disorder is the clinical term now. In the past, they called it alcoholism. They don't do that anymore because alcoholism isn't something that is diagnosable. But there is some, if there are certain substances that you can take in sufficient quantities, that your brain chemistry gets whacked out. Your brain chemistry is completely off kilter. And you will compulsively do a behavior whether you like it or not. It's not distracting you from anything. It's not bringing you one iota of joy. You hate it every second, but you're doing it anyway. That is not, I think, what we're talking about. We're talking about things that in the ordinary course of events, we do, like Jen was saying, to get just to put your mind off of whatever it is that you should be dealing with, and you're not. And in, you know, I you know, 40 years ago, people talked about alcoholism as a disease, like something you could catch, like a cold. And if you were an alcoholic, you were an alcoholic forever. I don't care for that. And I'm glad that I got into recovery when I did, because nowadays it's treated like post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or anything else. There are mental, there are behavioral therapies that can help you get back to, you know, normal. There are medications you can take. But again, I think when we start talking about illness, we're not talking about heedlessness. We're not talking about the thing that affects the majority of us on a day-to-day basis, right? I mean, for most people, you know, it's difficult. It doesn't have to rise to the level of a mental illness to be something that you do that has negative consequences for you in the long run, right? Can I jump in?
Oh, I was just going to say that this discussion has kind of started to blend intoxication and addiction. We've never really kind of made that distinction, right?
And that's why I tried to bring it up at the beginning a little bit, to say that I don't think this is about addiction, right? It can be, but it doesn't have to be. Because I don't think that most people would consider themselves to be addicted to a lot of things they do to take them out of the present moment, right? Addictions certainly do that. But there are tons of things that happen that aren't addictions that also do that. And the thing I wanted to avoid was lumping it, saying that it's just addiction is the problem. If you're not addicted, you're fine. Like, no, you know. If you're addicted, you're definitely got things to work out. You should seek medical help. But you know, I don't think that this precept is here to get us. If you're a compulsive drinker, this precept is not going to get you to stop drinking at all, right? That's not what this is for. This is for something else. You know, if you have an addiction like that, like a diagnosable medical condition, you get medical help, you get medication, you get therapy, then you get to a point where, okay, now I can begin dealing with the things that are deluding me. My TV watching is excessive, or this or that. You know, that I think that is the tool that this precept is you know, meant to be used upon. You know,
that's helpful. Thanks very much.
Go for it, man. You have more to say.
I was going to say something along those lines that. Maybe intoxication could be defined as really just this constant pushing and pulling away from reality that we all do, right? An intoxicant is something that enables that pushing and pulling. An addiction would be a compulsive use or compulsive behavior, right? I mean, I always think about addiction, the key word there is compulsion. It's like where you should have a choice, but you don't. You can't choose otherwise. It's like what Jennifer was saying, right? That, you know, try stopping. And if you can't stop, then that's an addiction.
Seek medical help at that point.
Yes.
Yeah. Jennifer?
I wanted to add a little bit to that. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Dave. When you said the present moment, because I think that is the consequence we're dealing with here. And to Betty's point, This is not rational, particularly as you get along the spectrum closer to addiction. There isn't a thing in the world about it, in my opinion, that is rational. So you can't reason your way through that, through this, with which makes it very difficult. And it does affect one physically and mentally. In the case of our practice, spiritually. But to me, the whole point that what we're talking about, and you were talking about consequences, is it is so hard. It is so hard to stay in the present. I mean, I try. I try almost going into it knowing that I will fail, but let me just try for this moment here. And when we have that chocolate chip cookie or the bowl of ice cream or the glass of wine or the joint or the whatever, we are making that more difficult. And the point of my practice as a Buddhist, throwing that out there. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe others have a different perspective, but is to try and stay within that present moment as much as I can, because that is where my life is. And the more of those moments that I throw away, the more I'm just throwing away my life. So that's, to me, is the crux of the matter. And what I think it's Bodhidharma, I don't know which one who says this, but no intoxicants can be taken in. When you get that, when you get how important that is and how hard it is to do that, no intoxicants can be taken in, because you don't want to make it any harder. That's the way I look at it.
The no intoxicants can be taken in is actually from our precept handbook, and that we and all of our cousin, like Dharma Rain, uses, and all the affiliated Zen org. It's a fairly recent creation, right? But it's something that's in our particular tradition.
Oh, I thought it was in the Dogen section.
It's like it's similar, but not exactly like that. Ours is a little bit more, you know. The one you're citing is the one that we're all familiar with. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So I was thinking about, you know, like, what makes alcohol appealing to people. And I think part of it, at least when you're young, is that it lowers your inhibitions, you know? And so I think that's the thing. It's like, even if you don't want to be intoxicated and you don't want to be a mess and all of that, there is a certain appeal to, like, oh, you have a drink and you can finally go talk to that cute person at the bar, or go, you know, tell that jerk what you really think about him, or whatever it is you want to use that sort of power for. And so, but what I also find interesting is you do want to be in the moment, but you want it to be more honest, you know, than life normally is. Or the way we, like, conduct ourselves in the world. And so what I think is interesting is I feel like as I meditated more, I find myself being more honest, you know? So I feel like you can achieve that, you know, without alcohol. It's just so much easier for people to just pick up a drink and do it. So
when you said that, it reminded me of something that tickled me when I was reading all these various, there's a million translations of all of these things, and having to sort through them and trying to get to the crux of it is difficult. But one of my favorites is the Buddha himself back in the day talked about intoxicants, and they generally talked about them in the things that they lead to. And the one that I found really quickly here was that, you know, intoxication can lead to the loss of wealth, increased quarreling, susceptibility to illness, disrepute, and weakening of wisdom. And the part that tickled me is when you talk about lowering inhibitions, in some of the translations I saw, that word disrepute isn't there. The word indecent exposure is there, which I thought was hilarious. So I'm like, I need to party with this guy because he sounds fun. You know, but yeah, I think you're, you know, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a reason why we gave up our perfectly contented lifestyles as hunters and gatherers to take up the nightmare that is farming, because yeah, that just that draw that is there, right? I was going to say something else, and I don't remember what it was.
Hey, Dave, your point about agriculture, I was reading this book and how we domesticate animals and wheat and all that stuff. And one of the premises of those books was that wheat has domesticated us, because we do everything we can to, like, you know, have more wheat. Anyway, that's, sorry, off topic.
No, it's a rich subject. I mean, one of those accidents of history. It just so happened, you know, if North America had had all the farm animals and Europe didn't, then history would look entirely different, because the Europeans just, like, lived with all these farm animals and got all these weird illnesses. And when we came over here, all the natives died because we were filthy, right? But yeah, we happened upon wheat. We found out that rotten wheat makes us feel great. And that set the whole course of human history down a different path. We're getting close to being out of time, but something that I wanted to say is that I don't think that one ought to take this as a prohibition against worldly pleasures, right? We talk about, the Buddha tried that. The Buddha did the part where they went off and wore only a ragged loincloth and ate one bit of rice every day. And turns out that's not the way to go. And so I think that if you find yourself thinking about this precept and thinking, well, I shouldn't do anything that causes me any degree of pleasure, I don't think that's it. You know, you can listen to music, have a drink. I mean, go do what do you, you know, but you continue practice, you remain attentive. And when you see things drifting off the rails, come back to the practice and pay more attention, right? Like that is it. Paying attention, avoiding heedlessness, right? So yeah, this is just a really long way of saying, I don't think this precept is about alcohol. This precept is about something entirely different. But you know, back in ancient India, what did they have to distract themselves with? They had sex and alcohol. And so that's why there's a precept about sex and there's a precept about alcohol. If they had iPhones in ancient India, you could be sure that there'd be a precept about iPhones too. They just didn't have those then. So they went with what they know.
But technology, we did not include that among our list of distractions.
It was on my list, but it didn't come up, so I skipped it. But technology is absolutely there, right? But I'm looking at a computer right now. And I don't think that I'm engaging in delusion. I'm using this tool for what it's intended for. But if I'm staring at a computer screen at 3 o'clock in the morning when I ought to be sleeping and getting ready for work, that's a completely different story, right? Any closing remarks? It's 8:55. We stop at 9, right?
The question.
Yes.
Or just a thought. How often do you think that people use spiritual pursuits as sort of this intoxicant fulfillment? You know, do you know what I mean? Like shifting one intoxication for another, like following some spiritual path.
That is a very rich subject. And that's something that in my research for this came up a lot, you know, I think that for me can be addressed by Sangha, right? Like the Buddha talks about not going off and doing this by yourself. That's why Sangha is part of it, because I feel like particularly if you engage in a practice like this alone, then that delusion is a very real danger. You can start getting high on your own supply and believing all sorts of crazy things. That's why we count on one another to keep us in check. But you can absolutely go off the rails with this sort of thing, and a lot of people do, but That's why we're here with one another, to keep each other honest. In case anybody thinks that they've become the awakened one, we can all check them, right?
Well, there are people who go off and meditate for maybe a month at a time. That can be extreme. It can be considered a big escape.
Yeah, but I always think of the example. There's that Japanese cult that did the sarin bombing in the subway. Like that was the result of some Buddhist guy who was a Buddhist and decided to go off and start his own practice, ultimately convinced himself that he was the second coming of Jesus Christ and that he needed to gas the subway. Now, if he had a Sangha around him, maybe somebody would have said, look, you're not Jesus, bud. And maybe don't do that, you know? So that was somebody whose religious path definitely led them to a place of extreme delusion, right? We're about out of time?
Tyler has
his. Oh, Tyler, go for it.
Oh, yeah, I guess it was just on that topic. It was, and even, you know, short of the sort of more, you know, thinking of Jesus or getting, starting your own cult or whatever, even just, you know, how are you using your Buddhist practice? Like, are you using meditation as a way to avoid your problems and try to get them out? Or are you using Zazen to come into your problem? Like, so how are you using these tools? I think there's the term like spiritual bypassing, right? Like, am I using this to get around my problems instead of face my problems or whatever it is? And if you're using it for that purpose, I think it's it definitely can become an intoxicant. Or people who, you know, who have really positive experiences at a session might find themselves chasing that feeling again, right? They're like, I had this one moment where I just felt euphoric with, you know, letting things go or something. And then that's all they say, like, don't focus on those moments because you'll become intoxicated with it and chase it. And it's not some big thing that's going to necessarily ruin your life and you're not going to, but what are you doing it for? Kind of what's your, yeah. So that's kind of what I was thinking about.
I think Domio talks about that all the time, where people have these sort of transformative experiences and her job is to tell them not to get so excited about it. Like, talk them down a little bit, say, that's fine, but, you know, settle into that and maybe go somewhere else with it. But yeah, you were talking about, you know, getting, I definitely came to Zen Buddha to escape my world. Like I didn't come to Buddhism, I was chased into it. And fortunately for me, the practice was able to shine a light on the things that were wrong with me. And I realized, well, maybe I need to seek some medical attention for these things. So Buddhism definitely showed me where the problems were, but psychiatrists helped me solve those problems. But yeah. Had I not had the right kind of guidance, maybe I would have spent the rest of my life trying to meditate the pain away. It's 9:00. We're done. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. That was fun, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. That was excellent.
Thanks, Dave.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.